A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is my podcast, The Invisible Gift, a show about turning disability into possibility. From a young age, I was told I had a disability that would make it impossible for me to achieve and flourish in life. I struggled in school and felt I was not truly understood or supported. On my long road to becoming the owner of multiple businesses, I have learned that dyslexia was not my disability, but rather my invisible gift. My dyslexia challenged me every day, but it was also what made me into an independent thinker, a creative, and gave me that hard-working mindset that has taught me to never be discouraged by failure. I realised there are many people out there just like me. So I wanted to learn more about them and how we can all transform our greatest challenge into our invisible gift. Welcome to my podcast.
What happened there is I said to Andrew, you open the show.
No, you didn't. You went, let's go back to more of a formal format.
Well, let's just tell them at the beginning of the show, off the top, welcome to the Invisible Gift Podcast.
I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is the Invisible Gift See, now you've cocked me out. I said this perfectly earlier. I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is the Invisible Gift Podcast, a podcast about turning disability into possibility.
There we go.
Yeah, I practiced that for like 4 days.
Well, you've had all this advice from previous guests about how to learn lines.
Yeah.
How's your week been?
Oh, been wonderful. We've had some great stuff going on in the construction world.
You've been a busy guy. I tried to call you a couple of times and...
Yeah, you know, trying to call me is like trying to call the dead.
I get told to message your assistant.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, do you know who I am? I'm the co-host of the Invisible Gift Podcast.
Yeah, the co-host now.
I've given myself that new title.
Oh.
I'm part of the furniture, aren't I now? This is episode 7, season 2.
Does that make you captain co-host?
No, I don't think so. You know, there'll be a dispute about who owns the IP in a minute.
Nope.
So last week on the show,
yes,
you chatted to Michael Fabry, the comedian.
We did indeed.
Clearly his comedy hasn't rubbed off.
Oh, harsh.
I'm joking. But it was a great chat.
It was a great chat. And
say that a lot, you know. If I was a listener, one of the things I would say is, there's not a lot of substance. Everything they got, James especially just goes, oh, it was a great chat.
All right, it was a shit chat.
No, don't swear, because there's kids listening to this show.
What?
No, this is...
Can we change his watershed?
If you haven't listened to that episode, go back at some point and make sure to have a listen.
Yeah, and guys, you should go back and listen to that. And if you haven't listened to season 1 yet, if you're joining us at season 2, welcome. And if not, go back to season 1 and you'll hear some great chats we had in there.
For anyone joining us in season 2 who's just found out about the show, why don't you give us a little bit of context? Who are you? What do you do? Why did you start this show?
It's not bad. That's not a bad thing to start with. So if you are just joining us, I am Andrew Kitley and I am dyslexic. And I do also have ADHD. And me and James spoke a long time ago when I first come to him, and I wanted to make a podcast about turning negative thoughts and dyslexia and neurodiversity into positives, because I'm a positive guy. Anyone that knows me knows I love positivity. And do you know what? I was looking at a lot of dyslexic things and there's so much bloody negativity out there. And I was like, screw this, we're going to turn it into a positive. And that's what this show's about.
I think that's a great explanation.
Thanks, mate.
If you are new and you're wondering who on earth I am and what this voice is, I'm James. I am the captain at One Fine Play, which is the production company making this show for and with Andrew. I'm only here because of Andrew's dyslexia. It means that reading scripts and going through pointers that the producer of the show, Connor, has provided proved tricky in season 1, I think it's fair to say. So I'm sort of here as a prompt, but it's been 7 episodes now, and I feel like I've got my feet under the table.
Yeah, and if you guys want to hear a snippet of what it did sound like, because you won't see it in season 1 because of the wonderful editing, listen to episode 1 of season 2 and you'll hear a little short bit of it.
I think it's fair to say that our moments in this same room that we're in now, it was challenging
horrible
at times. but I think there are a few people, if you're a hard, true fan of the show, you will have heard us whinging about that before. So let's
get into it.
Let's get into it. So this week, you caught up earlier in the week with executive head teacher for Specialist Dyslexic School Moon Hall in Reigate, Michelle Catterson.
Yep. Michelle, I discovered through the British Dyslexia Association when we was having a conversation, and they said, you have to meet Michelle. And I tell you what, I'm glad I did. She is a dyslexic warrior. Not dyslexic herself, but my God, her understanding of dyslexia is unbelievable.
And I think we should just give a special mention at this point to the charity.
Yeah, the British Dyslexia Association does amazing things for dyslexia, early detection. They do, and all these other things. It's just supporting out there, and this is what a lot of people don't realise. There is lots of support out there, and the British Dyslexia Association works with a lot of other charities as well to make sure that the message is really put out there across the board. They said to me in a meeting, which I absolutely loved, is when they've done their job correctly, they won't be around anymore, because that means their job's done, and that's their goal. What a beautiful goal to have.
So on this episode, you chat to Michelle. We learn about the history of Moon Hall, what it does that's different to other schools and why that's so effective for dyslexic kids. And you delve into the challenge of telling your boss that you're dyslexic. But first off, my man Andrew finds out whether Michelle is dyslexic and how or why she got interested in this specific area.
Let's take a listen.
So thank you for coming on the podcast anyway.
No problem.
So we're here to talk about dyslexia today.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm correct. We've spoken before, so I'm going to repeat for everyone listening. Is you're not actually dyslexic, are you?
No, I'm not dyslexic. No, I actually get asked that quite often. but yeah, no, I'm not. And I've got quite a lot of staff here who are dyslexic or who have other learning difficulties. So I think being a teacher isn't a barrier. If you are dyslexic and you do want to become a teacher, by all means do, because some of my best teachers are dyslexic or have found school difficult at some point. Not dyslexic.
So what made you leave Scotland? You obviously left Scotland for a reason. What made you get into dyslexia school down here? What was your reasoning behind that?
So I've been teaching over 20 years now. I went straight into teaching after I'd done my degree, and I'd done a bit of research for a big science company and just sort of decided that wasn't for me. And then went straight into teaching. So when I started teaching, I was only 20, so I was quite young. There wasn't much of an age difference between the oldest pupils and me, but I just knew that that's what I always wanted to do. And even before I was a teacher, in the summer holidays, I sort of volunteered at kids' camps and worked with children with learning difficulties. So I've always had an interest in it. Even my first teaching job, when I had free lessons that I should have been using for planning and preparation time, I went to the learning support department just to sort of see if there was anything I could do and help out with some of the kids. So I've always been really, really interested in working with children with special educational needs. Taught in Scotland for a while, and then relocated down south with my husband, and I had two boys at the time, and I've had a third one since we've moved down here. And the job came up in this school, and I was just kind of quite blown away by it, like really intrigued. How does it work? I've never taught in a school before where it is just all the children are dyslexic. You would have a sort of cohort of pupils that would have SEN needs or be dyslexic, but not a school that's just full of dyslexic children. So it's quite unique. And I think it was just different, and it sort of appealed to me. It sparked my interest a little bit. So started off here as deputy head, and then took on the acting head position. And then I've been head teacher now for 3 years.
Can you tell me a bit about the history of Moon School and how it was established and everything?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting. I think it should be made into a film one day, if I'm honest. What happened was Berry Baker, who is our founder, she has a dyslexic son, and she quickly realised that he couldn't access mainstream education the way that it was being delivered in the classroom. So she decided to homeschool him. So I've been to their house. Their house is actually called Moon Hall, which is the names of the school as well. So I went to Moon Hall, their home, and I've sat at their table. And what basically happened was word got out that she was doing a really good job with teaching her child who was dyslexic, and other parents started saying, oh, would you teach my child or could you help my child? So she then ended up with loads of children around this quite large dining table. And then eventually the dining table got too small. There was no more space at the dining table. So they fundraised and they built a school, which was called Moon Hall Dorking, which is nearer Dorking and nearer their home. And it started at year three and it went up to year six and focused on teaching dyslexic children. But then what happened was the parents got to year six and they went, Berry, what happens now? Like this needs to continue. They just can't go back into mainstream education quite yet. They're making huge progress. So they fundraised again and Berry Baker and her husband David Baker bought the school that I'm sat in right now, which is called Moon Hall Reigate, nearer to Reigate, but it was an existing school. It was a prep school. And then historically it was a school for military children. And before that it was a girls finishing school. But originally it was built, I think it was 1875. It says it on the front of the school. I should know this. but it was a husband and wife from London that were involved in the brewing industry, so made an awful lot of money. And this was their country home. And when they designed this building, the front of the building is very much like Hogwarts. Even when you're coming up the drive, you think you're approaching Hogwarts. It is really magical. But the back of the building is mock Tudor and it's completely different. And that's because the husband and wife couldn't decide on the design. So one designed the front and one designed the back. So the building is like an old, it's grade two listed. It's an old stately home. But that's quite important for our children as well, because some of them have had quite a bad experience of school. Coming here, it feels like someone's house, it feels like someone's home, so that it doesn't feel really corporate and sort of clean lines. There are wonky bits in the building and floorboards that are a little bit uneven, but that I think in itself helps the children to feel a little bit more at ease as well. So yeah, that's a little bit of history of the school.
And this is a bit of a special podcast for me, because nearly everyone I've spoken to, bar two of our guests we've had on before, on season one, which was Paloma and Rod, you're the only other person we've had from the education system. And to be honest, although we try and keep the podcast as positive as possible, we all can't help but feel that in some ways, a lot of schools, unless people went to private school, it seems to be schools didn't really, we learned a lot in them, but didn't do us very well. A lot of us got told, you know, you're never going to be anything, you're never going to amount to anything. So for me, it's great to have you on the podcast, because you're 100% dedicated to dyslexic people and people with neurodiversity. So that's going to be a really interesting approach. So I'm really interested, I'm sure most people listening, because we normally just go into like the origin story, which we kind of get back to a little bit. But what is it exactly... Moon Hall School does that's different compared to most other schools? Because I'm sure there's hundreds of things you've talked for hours, but
yeah, how long have we got? I think the first difference that anybody would notice, and actually I kind of probably mean the pupils in this, is that this is the first time for my pupils when they come to Moon Hall that they are surrounded by other dyslexic individuals. For many of my pupils, they've been the only dyslexic kid in the class. And that's really, really difficult, especially for someone who's dyslexic, where there is no effect on their intelligence. They're of average intelligence or higher, but they're not made to feel like that when they're in their classroom setting. So they've went through a lot of their school life believing that they're different and that they're not good enough, or they're different to their peers, or they're never going to amount to the same sort of successes that their peers might be able to experience. So that's the first thing that's really different when you come to Moon Hall. And I think I can only imagine, because I'm not dyslexic, but how empowering that must be when the stigma is just gone. You're now surrounded by children who understand you, who share the same difficulties. And a lot of my kids will say, oh, please don't make me read out in front of everybody in class, because that's what they've been made to do in the past. And and obviously all of our teachers are like, no way, we won't make you do that. But it is actually quite surprising. When I do assemblies, I'll say to the kids, who would like to read out something at assembly? And I have too many children to actually use in the assembly. And yes, absolutely. Some of them will really trip over their words and they'll find it quite difficult and they'll maybe stumble a little bit or they'll get nervous. But what a great opportunity for them to do something that's been such a negative experience for them in the past, and to now feel they're in a place where they're accepted and it's okay to make those mistakes. Even if you do read out aloud, it's okay if you say the word wrong or you, and I've even done some interviews. I interviewed Captain Tom's daughter, Hannah. And one of the kids really struggled with the question. We practiced it, but they got a little bit nervous. So in the middle of the interview, I just said, oh, do you want me to help? And they went, yes, please. So then I kind of read out the question and then they repeated it back. So I think, that's just one of the major things that's really, really noticeable, is being in an environment where you're surrounded by like-minded individuals. And then that sort of, once they get through the door, it's the teachers, they get the kids. So I mentioned that not expecting them to read out in class. That understanding that the teachers have and the gentle encouragement that they provide, it's just, it's wonderful, really. It's a really rewarding place to come to work each day.
I suppose if I looked at it from my point of view, it would have been amazing knowing that everyone in the class was similar to me. So we're all kind of on the same journey together, whereas before you had to try and avoid anyone seeing that you weren't able to do so. And that's not just in reading out loud or anything learning. You always at school, it's more, I always say, I think school's the closest thing to prison there ever is. And you don't ever want to show your weaknesses. But I suppose the great thing is when you've got a support network in a team of, in your peers, it must make you feel a lot better. I like that. I can imagine as well, now you've said that, if I was in an environment where I wouldn't be embarrassed about stuttering and stumbling over my words when I'm reading out loud, I probably would have done it a lot more. So, yeah, that's really nice.
And sometimes just that when you're more relaxed and at ease with the things that you find difficult, you can laugh about it a little bit. So sometimes the kids, when they'll get it wrong, they'll go, oh, for goodness sake, like, I just can't do this. So the kind of the anxiety that they might have had in the past and the worry not to be able to read something properly kind of disappears a little bit as well. But I mean, that's me talking about like sort of the best example, but we still have children that will find it difficult to read out aloud. They don't feel comfortable letting everyone know just how difficult they find things. But I think I would say 100% it's a lot more easier here to make those mistakes in front of your peers than it might be in a classroom with 29 other kids that don't have any difficulties.
And how many kids do you have in the class?
So our maximum class size is 12, which, yeah, it's brilliant because I still teach, even though I'm head teacher, so I've got a year 11 group. So I mean, actually, none of our teachers really stand at the front of the classroom and talk to the kids. We're always very much sort of down with the children. And it's almost more like a seminar or something that you'd experience at university, where you sit down with them. And having only 12 kids in the class, I can see who's not understanding straight away, who's not got it, or who's kind of sitting daydreaming and looking into space. So you can help much quicker than, I suppose, schools that I've taught in the past, because I've not always taught in the independent sector. I'm probably half and half, state school sector and independent sector. Sometimes when you've got 30 kids in your class, you don't realise until they sit a test, when you think, oh, they've really not understood this topic. And by that point, they're falling further and further behind. So the small class sizes are brilliant. for teachers being able to see who's struggling, who's not getting it, but also for those kids that are really getting it need to be pushed on a little bit more and challenged a little bit more. So yeah, 12 in a class, it's brilliant, it's really good.
So do you stay on kind of mainstream education? Because we always say when I speak to people in the podcast, their strengths normally go somewhere else, like they're great at sport or they're great at acting or they're great at making things or the more creative parts of the industry. Does the curriculum kind of stick to the state schools or have you kind of tried and changed it up to suit the students?
I think what we're always aware of is that as much as Moon Hall is designed around the needs of the child, society always isn't, and next step colleges aren't always as well. So we've kind of got this sort of two platform provision where there's the essential things that we have to teach so that when they leave us, they can go on and be successful wherever they go. But we also want to create a curriculum that they enjoy and that they can access as well. So we follow the national curriculum. We do the exact same GCSEs that you'd expect at any other school. We don't do languages. So what my kids will say is that they struggle enough with learning English. Don't teach me French or Italian or whatever it is. So we don't do languages here at the school, but everything else is pretty much the same as you would find at a comprehensive school down the road. One of the things that we did change though, because a lot of our children don't live locally to the school. They travel quite far to come here because there's not a lot of schools like ours. So we don't really have the opportunity to do lots of after-school clubs and those sort of wider extracurricular things. So what we decided to do, and partly because I was teaching Year 11 Biology Lesson 6, which is last lesson of the day, on a Friday, and I think I spent more time just sort of prodding them to kind of waken up and pay attention. Yeah. So on a Friday afternoon, we don't have any academic lessons. So the whole school is on extracurricular activities. So we do things like film club, chess club, debating. We've got forest schools, go-kart racing, all of these kind of extracurricular things that our children will shine at. So yeah, Friday afternoons are awesome, even for the teachers as well, because the teachers take those clubs. And it's been good for us as a staff, because I've got some teachers that have came forward and said, oh, I'd like to run this club. And I didn't even know that they were amazing singers or that they could speak a different language until this opportunity arose. So yeah, just to sort of go back to your question, we follow the national curriculum, but it's tailored to the needs of the kids. So some kids might struggle with the national curriculum, so we've got to sort of phase things back a little bit for a little while. But generally, we're following the national curriculum, same GCSEs at the end of Year 11 that you would expect at another school.
It's interesting that you said about debating, because I have said this, and it's slightly going off subject here, but I've said the one skill I think everyone should learn is debating. And, you know, it's used quite a lot in the American education, like they have debate teams and stuff like that. But outside of private schools, state schools don't really, I mean, I think we covered like half a lesson once in English about debating, my favourite lesson I've ever had. That must be amazing for the kids debating. I think that's really cool. I bet they're quite good at it as well.
Yeah, because typically with a lot of our kids here, they're very good at putting forward their arguments verbally, but might not be as good at putting it down on paper and sort of doing the argument that way. So a lot of them are very articulate and can hold a really good argument. I know that when they want to come in a non-school uniform and I'm saying, no, it's not really appropriate. So yeah, we do. But it's really important for them to learn those negotiation skills and to be able to have an opinion and then sort of put forward that argument for that opinion as well. So yeah, we encourage that with debating club, but we also run a class here called ESB, which is the English Speaking Board exams. And as part of ESB, they have to sort of pick a topic that they're passionate about and then put forward a sort of case for it. And then they actually get examined on it. So they've got to stand up in front of sort of a panel of examiners. And we get really good results in that. So it's exactly what you say. It demonstrates how good our children are at speaking in front of people when given the right support and sort of skills to be able to do it.
You've actually just touched on a question which I've been asking everyone in season two. I've been trying to listen to listeners with their questions, and one of the main, there are some, actually you've probably got more questions to answer than anyone, because a lot of them are from parents, which this podcast actually is kind of geared more towards older people with dyslexia, but it's come across that I think a lot of parents with children with dyslexia listen to it as well, which is obviously great. But the question everyone always gets asked is, should I tell my boss that I have dyslexia? Mm-hmm. My employer, not just boss, my employer, should I tell people at work I'm dyslexic? How did you tell people? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think there's a lot of stigma attached to that? Do you think it's a good idea, or we should embrace it a bit more? What's your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, things have changed. When I think back to when I was at school and the sort of stigma of the dyslexic child in the class that just couldn't understand or access the lessons, I'd say it's definitely changed, but it's not made the right amount of progress, in my opinion. So I think that there is still a stigma attached to it, and I think there's still a lack of understanding. So if you imagine, if you're sort of a new graduate and you're 20 years old, your boss might be 30, 40 years old, their experience and understanding of dyslexia is going to be quite different to the 20-year-old's experience. So I think there's a lot of education needed in the workplace, because people assume, wrongly, of course, that people with dyslexia are not going to achieve, or they're not intelligent, and that's not the case. They just need things modified or delivered in a different way. And somebody in the workplace, I can understand why they might feel uncomfortable about that. But I mean, I've seen corporate emails coming through to me more recently where people are actually signing off at the bottom of their signature, please excuse any sort of grammatical or spelling mistakes because I'm dyslexic. And I think that's amazing, just that somebody will put that at the bottom of the email signature. But it still happens. I mean, even on Twitter and things like that, you see people getting trolled for not being able to spell properly. And then they're having to sort of justify themselves, and that just shouldn't happen.
Yeah, I actually saw it this morning. I was on LinkedIn and I read a post from someone, and actually they were talking about they had a slightly foreign name, and to be honest, I didn't think it sounded foreign at all, and they said people struggled to spell it, and then all the comments and they were saying, I've just said enough of this, it's ridiculous, and loads of comments below was like everyone saying old people struggle to spell my name, like, and these are just a vast difference of names. But what was interesting wasn't about people spelling names that weren't inherently British wrong. It was just the fact that people were spelling everyone's name wrong. But everyone went on to, like, what's really funny is kind of there's a lot of cultural norms on having a go at people they think are wrong, but what they didn't realize is that they're actually insulting a very large group, 1 in 10 people in the world, about spelling. And I'm so terrible at spelling names. Names are like, I'm awful at spelling names. I can't. And I think I listened to them saying, well, they shouldn't write emails. The comments were horrendous. They was like, they shouldn't write emails. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't have that job. They're in far too much of a high position not to spell that. And I just want to go in there and go, you're so blinded by, you think that you're being marginalized and you're in turn marginalizing other people, and you don't realize you're doing it.
No, and it's all just ignorance, really, and it's lack of understanding. And I think that's what needs to change, is that in the workplace there needs to be more education of those middle managers and senior managers to sort of identify in their staff. So I've heard of some really good examples of companies being really open about it. So HSBC Bank have got an ambassador for neurodiversity, and they hold lots of webinars and different things like that. So there's a very open culture about sort of saying if you're finding things difficult, which is important, but that isn't the same in every workplace.
No, and I thought it's quite interesting. So me and the producers guys, Connor and James, discussed about kind of starting an initiative, which is it's like share your gift. That was it. Because we were saying, I openly talk about dyslexia, and I am really happy for anyone to know I have dyslexia, because I actually see it as an amazing thing. But I must admit, since I've been more vocal about it, a lot of people have said, oh, well, I wouldn't have told anyone about that. It's really interesting. And these are people without dyslexia. They're just like, why would you want to tell anyone that? How do you build that level of confidence up in your children to be kind of own their dyslexia, as it were?
I think it's gradual. It doesn't happen overnight. I think when we've got some children, so I have some children that will start here in the senior school, so year 7, 8, 9, that have been sort of school refusers, maybe suffering severely with anxiety and other sort of issues related to their school experience. So sometimes as soon as they come here, there's just an immediate change in them, and the parents will comment on that, that just all of a sudden the kind of weight is off their shoulders. But I would say that that's probably not the norm. What would happen more would be that it'd be a gradual build up. So when children typically start here at the school, we make the work a little bit easier intentionally, just so they can feel that sense of accomplishment and that they can do it. And then we build up, and that in itself is it's what the kids need to be able to do. They need to understand that they can do it and they can push themselves a little bit harder. So I think it's that gentle encouragement that happens over a period of time that helps them to believe in themselves. I think with children, they can tell when it's false praise. If we're just saying, oh, yeah, you're great, you're doing a great job, they get that. And I think they find that quite insulting as well. So the praise has got to be genuine and it's got to be deserved as well. Yeah. So, and I think that relationship between the teacher and the pupil, and not just the teacher, but all the support staff that we have at the school. I mean, even my receptionist has got a great relationship with the pupils. They'll come and speak to her for a little chat. And it's just that whole culture in the school that makes a difference to how the kid perceives themselves and feels about themselves.
When the kids leave, obviously, if they've been at your school the whole time, they've been used to being around similar people to themselves. How is it when, do you know how it is when they leave and go and spend, like, if they go to college at a different school? Have they ever come back and said that's a bit of a shock to them or anything?
Normally the year 11s can't wait to get out of here. And then very quickly in October, they start getting in touch and saying, can we come back for a visit? Can we come back for it? So we then have this sort of trickle of them just coming back to see us again. So, and we're really encouraging of that. We very much, and I even say it to the parents when they're leaving at the end of year 11, that we're still here for you. If you're struggling with your schooling or you're finding things difficult, then come back to us and we'll help and we'll talk you through things. So, they do have to sort of take a bit of a jump. They don't have that security blanket that they maybe had. But in saying that, we work really, really hard on independence from even quite early on here at the school, because we don't want any child to be completely reliant upon another adult to help them to be able to do things. So we use a lot of assistive technology, dictation software, trying to get them to reading software, different things like that, touch typing, writing. From the littlest kids in year 3, they learn how to touch type. So we're constantly trying to teach them skills that when they don't have an adult with them, that they can still manage to access the work. And I think just a lot of my kids, I say to them, don't be afraid to say that you're dyslexic. So when you go to college and the teacher maybe gives you a big bundle of worksheets and says, oh, I want you to read through these for tomorrow, say to your lecturer, actually, can I have these a week in advance so I've got a little bit longer to go through them? Or can you give me it electronically so that I can use some software that can help me go through things? So I think it's just teaching them and embedding that confidence in themselves to say just exactly what you do, like, oh, I'm dyslexic, and not have any issue with that, then that helps them. But I mean, our model here at the school is quite different to a typical school model where you might have a dyslexic kid in the class. So normally you'll have your classroom and you'll have a teaching assistant who'll be very much sat next to that pupil who's dyslexic and helping them with their work. That's not the way we want to do things here. So the teaching assistant here I mean, we actually don't have a huge amount of teaching assistants because the teacher should do a lot of the intervention, but the teaching assistant that's in the class would sort of just check that they understand and are you okay? You know what you're doing? Okay, fine. I'm going to be over here, but allow the kid to go on with it themselves. So, it's important that that happens because if we did have loads of teaching assistants and they were with the kids all the time, then yes, going to college where they need to be really independent and really sort of self-sufficient and really well organised would be a massive hurdle for them. So we would be putting them at a disadvantage if we didn't try and scale them up in that way.
Yeah, I love it.
I mean, what Michelle said in that is key. If you don't tell people, you can't get the help you need. And myself, I went to university when I was studying civil engineering, and the help you can get in education is quite large. But the thing is, a lot of people are embarrassed about having that conversation. And the thing is, you just got to do it because it will really help you. If you go back and listen to the conversation we had in season one with Chris Donnelly, he talks about how he got taught how to touch type at an early age to help him assist him with exams. And these are the sort of things that are out there now that can really help us. But if you don't ask, you won't get.
So do you remember the age at which you became more comfortable with talking about your dyslexia?
My dad's severely dyslexic, and my mum is stupidly the most confident person on the planet, and so is my dad. So for me, I've never worried about it. I grew up with a mantra which a lot of people don't like, but it's that your opinion of me is none of my business. So if you think I'm an idiot for saying it, good for you. That's up to you. But I run that through my whole life. So I'm confident in saying it, but I can empathize with people that it's not an easy thing to do. And I'm also knew from a very young age that I was always going to be my own boss because I am a terrible employee, as in I don't take power over me very well.
Is that why when I tell you to do things, you just purposefully do them differently? And I say, could you just say this line?
Hi, everyone. I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR, and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that wants to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
No.
So coming up, you talk about how parents should be framing dyslexia, i.e. is it a total positive or is it a challenge? And I think that's an interesting thing to get into because you've talked a lot about parents and and we have lots of parents who listen to this show in order to learn about their children with dyslexia and how to support them. So that's definitely going to be interesting to hear. You also talk about the importance of the Minister for Education having relevant experience and the need for reform, which is another interesting topic. We tried to stay away from politics, and we've also tried to not allow this show to be a soapbox for things that should change at a governmental level, but I'm keen to hear what that's about. And Michelle shares why dyslexics' lateral thinking is a gift, which I know is something that you're a big believer in and has massively helped you as an engineer.
Yeah, Michelle touches on lots of points. This is full of information, this one. And she has some real great views on how we can change things. I mean, the problem is with the podcast, we, as most people who come on the podcast, are dyslexic. We talk a lot about our experiences, and it's great to have another view from someone who's at the cold face of it, trying to push through new practices within the education system. And Michelle touches on the fact that you know, we've got to get our mind right on how we deal with things, but let's focus on the great things we do as dyslexic people. And the kids she inspires really, really embrace that. Let's take a listen.
I'm soon to be a parent in a few months, well, our first baby's due. So I'm for the parents listening. What's the best thing to do when you have a dyslexic child? Because I seem to get two really different types of parents come to me. Some are very much like me and just like all positive, don't worry, it'll be fine. And I said this on the podcast we recorded last week. My dad always said to me, if you can't be good at school, just be good at something. So whatever it is, just throw your energy into it. At one stage it was martial arts, and then it was into drama, and then it was into sports like basketball. I just done anything, but I could become obsessed with it, like that. And that kind of made me feel better. And most of the people I speak to on the podcast says similar things, like they would throw themselves completely into like gymnastics or playing an instrument or stuff like that. And then you've got the other parents that just, it because they love their kids so much, freak out, and they really don't know what to do about it. What's the best way for parents to deal with the situation, especially if they don't have an understanding of dyslexia? So you've got two kinds of parents, ones that don't have an understanding and ones that went through such horrific things as a dyslexic person themselves, that they're terrified their child's going to go through the same. What sort of advice can you give to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you were talking, that's what I was thinking. A lot of it will depend on the parents' experience of school. If they've had a really supportive and good, positive experience of school, then I think they would tend to be more relaxed about things. If they've had a really horrendous experience of school, which unfortunately has happened for a lot of our parents, they tend to be a little bit more anxious about things, or wanting to make sure that their child's experience of school is completely different to what they had to go through. I think there's obviously the hereditary link with dyslexia. So at my school, I've got a lot of parents that are dyslexic as well. So we've got to bear that in mind with communications, that we don't send out lots of letters and that the bulletin's kind of logical and things like that. I mean, I've even done some bulletins where I've not written anything. I've recorded a video just to help parents a little bit. But yeah, I think it comes down to education for the parents as well. And there's loads of help out there. I mean, I've done an additional training course in dyslexia with the British Dyslexia Association. So I'm still trying to understand and better my experience of working with dyslexic kids. But there's loads of free webinars out there that the British Dyslexia Association does, that Made by Dyslexia do. I also follow a lot of social media groups as well, where there's a lot of parents on there, because, again, I can learn a lot from what the parents are saying about their experiences and what they're finding. So I follow a lot of the social media groups and listen to what's being posted and what the concerns are. And I would say for a parent, I'll see quite often on those social media groups, they'll say, oh, we did the test, just found out they're dyslexic. I don't quite know how to tell them, or should I tell them? Should I keep it quiet? Or, and I think the parents, they get a lot of support from the other parents within the group as well. And because a lot of it's anonymous or you don't know the person, you can kind of be quite honest about your apprehensions or your worries for your child and different things. But I would say for parents, it's join the social media groups, look at the free webinars that are available, and then speak to the school. Because in every school, I mean, I know in this school, we've got a sort of an abundance of expertise and support, but every school will have someone who should understand dyslexia and SEN, and that will be the school SENCO or the head teacher. And it's just sort of building up a good relationship with the head teacher and the SENCO. And the outcomes that have been most positive for me as head teacher have been the ones where I've worked really closely with the families. So we're all working together. We've all got the same purpose. We've all got the same goal. And it works out best for the child. So I think sometimes for parents, and I completely understand this, they might approach the school, they feel they're not getting the right support or the right help, and that can become hugely frustrating. So I would just say sort of keep trying to foster that positive relationship with the school and the teachers at the school, because it will inevitably benefit the child as much as possible at the end of it all.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's hard for parents, and you're right, support groups. I find it interesting, actually, what you said about reading comments, because that's what I do. I read comments to see how I should ask people questions in the show, because I came into this completely, when I said about doing something about dyslexia, I only had in my mind the positive things. In all honesty, my ignorance made me realise that I didn't actually see any downsides to it. So I kind of wanted to go in with all this happy, chirpy, cheery, yay, it's great. And then when I realised that not everyone, or not that many people who are in it, feel that way. And I think that kind of makes me really lucky, because my parents, my dad was, if I'm on the high spectrum of dyslexia, he's so far away from me and higher, it's unbelievable. But he always said, well, it never affected me. I started a business as soon as I could, and I've never had any problems. Yeah. I just can't spell anything, and that's it. And he can't say a lot of words as well. But because I think I've always had that influence in my life, and my mum is so academically intelligent, they are two opposite sides of the world. So every time we struggled at school, my dad never made out as if it was going to be the end of my life if I didn't do well at school. So I think that really helped me. But like I said, I started this podcast and was reading all the comments and was like, wow, there isn't people that have had that sort of upbringing. Because I suppose things were different. Like you said earlier, things are different back in when people were at schools in the 80s and 90s, that they're now raising children who have dyslexia, and their children's getting a very different approach on dyslexia than they were. So they still have in their head that it will affect them through life, and I don't think it will as much as they think it will, because it's different experiences.
Yeah, and I think you're quite right. Both you and I have a really positive experience of you've had a positive experience growing up, and I've got a really positive experience here of working with dyslexic children and the opportunities that they have. But that isn't the case in every school in the country. One of the things that in the work that I do with the British Dyslexia Association is that we're really trying to push on government to look at teacher training opportunities. So we have all these teachers that are trained every single year, and then they're all going out to school and in the classroom, but there's no, they don't have to do any SEN training as part of their teacher training qualification. Now, if there was some teacher training module included in that qualification, you've then got all these students going out into schools that, one, have a better understanding, but also might have some strategies that they can use. And I think we're just missing a massive opportunity there. And that should really change. And that'd be quite a quick fix thing for colleges to take on board and to train up their students in that way. But another sort of negative aspect of the lack of provision and the lack of understanding is that if you look at our prison systems, and if you look at the percentage of people in prison that have dyslexia, it's around about 40 to 50% of inmates that have dyslexia or some form of reading difficulties or literacy difficulties. And by that point, you've completely missed an opportunity to have that positive impact on a child's life to prevent that from happening. I'm not saying there can't be reform and things like that, but could you imagine if that inmate had been understood at school, been given the right support at school?
Past people I've spoken to said that the problem is the education system is so old and so big that it's impossible, or it feels impossible to make moves. So there's a lot of people like yourself that are trying to push, but there's not enough things happening. And I myself, honestly, do feel like the education systems, and obviously I've been in for a while, so I've got to be careful what I say here, but it feels like it was geared up for a time that we no longer live in. How do you think the government would be best suited to deal with the kind of issue with neurodiversity?
I think, first of all, when you've got an education minister that's leading on education in the country, they should come from an education background. So they should have actually been a teacher themselves or worked in a school, because I understand ministers have advisors and people that tell them what's happening, different things like that, but nothing beats that first-hand experience of working in a school and seeing what happens. So I think our ministers at the top are a little bit out of touch. And even look at what happened recently, where they hired this education guru and said, this is what you need to do in order to fix education and to have this sort of catch-up program and help with all the COVID impact and different things like that. And then he ended up resigning because the government wouldn't give him enough money to try and help children. So here you've got experts that are advising the government and it's just not happening. So I think, yes, our education system is going backwards. It's not even stagnant or sort of stayed in the same position. It's getting worse because even more recently, a lot of GCSEs had a percentage of coursework in them. So it's 20% and you could do your coursework and then 80% exam. Most GCSEs now have removed the coursework element. So it's all based on an end of 2 year exam. Yeah. Now, at the end of the day, that's just a memory test. That is just someone's ability to memorise what they've been taught and then convey that in an exam. I would far rather the exam system's more modular based, so they're getting regularly assessed on what they've understood in each topic, bring back coursework, even vocational qualifications, BTEC awards, where the kids are learning skills and facts and information at the same time. So I had hoped, with the whole impact of COVID, that there would be exam reform, that the government would actually look at the way that we do exams. We've not had to do exams now for 2 years. And I would hope they would question whether or not that is it really necessary, that the kids actually sit exams in the format that we've been doing. And I would hope that next year it changes. But I have no confidence in that, if I'm honest, which is a real shame. But in saying that, and not to sort of get too political or anything like that, but I work with an MP who's on the Education Select Committee, who's dyslexic, dyspraxic and dyscalculic. And he is really, really passionate about change for children across the country. So it's people like that that are on the Education Select Committee that have the opportunity to influence change and to try and get change to happen that are really, really important. And it's really good to work alongside him quite often if he's gone to Parliament or if he's got the Education Select Committee meeting. He'll give me a call and say, oh, how's things? He's actually asking about what it's like on the ground. How's this actually working? What about this new announcement? How does that impact on your pupils? And that's the kind of MPs that you really, really need, that are literally fighting and championing the child and making sure legislation changes.
Yeah, and you say not to get too political, but we do really. I mean, the problem is we can, I mean, it's funny, I've come to realise education's a bit like, the issues of education are the same issues they have in health in government, is the fact that we seem to allow people to do we try not to change anything too much at school and then allow companies to try and deal with issues when they get out, because one, they're funded by private organisations 9 times out of 10 who can deal with it themselves, and we deal with the problems when they come up and we move on, which is the same as health. You know, if you've got a problem, they throw pills at you and try and get, but they don't go backwards and go, well, this is where the health problems start. And equally, it's the same as having a health secretary that's never been in the health industry. It's we kind of do need people who are experiencing, like you said, the one thing, and I think it's obvious from how you're saying it, is we need passion. And unless you've chosen that vocation in life to do that, your passion isn't, the person that hasn't chosen that, their passion is politics, not education, you see. So you're right, you need someone who is extremely passionate about that. And I do think you've said exactly the same as my other guests have said. So there's
that's all right then.
I think it's true, but I think I do worry that it's too much of a beast to try and turn around. And I know they say these comments all the time. I think a lot of the time the only way to solve these is complete reform in that sense, mm-hmm. and starting from scratch, because we're still, the whole system was set up during the Industrial Revolution. This is what schools was, let's train people to put them to work. Our work lives are nothing like that anymore.
Yeah, I agree. I was at a, it was like a conference or a summit, and Richard Branson was there, and he was saying, he sort of launched that he no longer asks people to put on their GCSE results and their A-level results on a job application because he sees them as pretty irrelevant, that it should be taken on interview skills, or then maybe do some problem solving tests and different things like that, because it's just so out of date. The skills that people need for the workplace are not going to be found in the GCSE results most of the time. They're going to be found in their ability to work as a team, and a lot of these skills that dyslexic people have, that creativity and that out of the box thinking, is what is fantastic and really exciting for organisations to take on board. And we had someone come to our school prize giving a couple of years ago, and they put out an advert in one of the papers, and the title of the advert was "Dyslexic People Only" to apply for the job, because he only wanted to recruit a dyslexic individual. And it's so right. Even in the classroom, if I'm doing a science experiment, I'll be like, right guys, 1, 2, 3, 4, this is how we do it. And then I'll look at a kid and I'll be like, why are you doing it that way? And they're like, oh, because this is like, that might be better. And at first I would, your sort of initial response is to go, no, you need to do it this way. And then you realise that they get to the same point by doing the stages in a different order, or by doing things a little bit differently. And it's those moments when an individual doesn't follow the set path, yeah, that they can find something quite unique, that sort of eureka moment that they've discovered something. And we need thinkers like that. We need people that won't just conform and that will do things a little bit differently to get an even better end result. I think it's 40% of UK self-made millionaires, yeah, are dyslexic. And that comes from people with an entrepreneurial mind, where they look at a situation and they think, oh, I'm not going to do it that way. I'm going to do it this way, or I can do that better. And that's the skills that are needed, that entrepreneurial thinking, where you don't just feel it's always been done this way, so we're going to continue to do it this way, or that's okay and that'll do. It takes these people to improve society because they want to take that chance and to think about things a little bit differently. So yeah, that creativity and that spirit to think about things in that way is a gift. And it's not something that I have, unfortunately. Being a scientist, I'm very much like 1, 2, 3, 4, that's how we should do things. And sometimes I wish I could, because actually even in my sort of personal life, I find it difficult when my kids and my husband, we have a kind of very common question that comes up, why are you doing it that way? Why are you doing it that way? Because I find it difficult to figure out why you're not doing it the way that I think it should be done. So yeah, I wish sometimes that I had a little bit more elasticity to my thoughts, and that I could sort of be comfortable and confident enough to take a chance and take a gamble on things. But yeah, I play it safe. I don't have that dyslexic gift, unfortunately.
Well, you're supporting the people with the dyslexic gift, so that's what's in.
I'm learning. So hopefully I'll absorb some of it.
So what would you say, I know we kind of covered it earlier, but what would you say to parents or kids listening, I'm hoping might have some kids, about if they've just recently found out they have dyslexia, what would be your parting advice with them?
I could imagine, so from some of the things I've read on the social media and different things like that, it could almost go two ways for a child, that when they're told that they've got that diagnosis, there's almost that relief that they think, oh, well, that's why I can't do this. And then they can start associating the things that they find difficult with their dyslexia. For some children, I can imagine it would also be quite daunting for them, because they don't really know what it means. Or they might have some stigma attached to it themselves, because there's maybe another dyslexic kid in the class, and they think, or they don't sort of associate themselves with that other kid and different things like that. So I think for the child, they're going to need a lot of reassurance from parents from school. And we've got books in our school library that talk about dyslexia and different things like that, and your sort of the skills that you have, and books about extraordinary people. We've got displays around the school with famous dyslexic individuals, so that there's lots of resources out there for when a child finds out that they're dyslexic, to make that experience as positive as possible for them. There's a lot of celebrities that are happy to now come out and say that they're dyslexic as well. We've got we have a house system here at the school, so we've got four different houses, and each of our houses is a famous dyslexic. So we've got Whoopi Goldberg, Keira Knightley, Lewis Hamilton, and Richard Branson. So those role models, and people like yourself as well that are dyslexic but successful, are really, really important for children to know that it's going to be okay. It might be tough and you might find things a little bit difficult, but we're here to help with that. But look at these sort of this for inspiration, and hopefully they can then associate with that as well.
Now I've heard that you've got famous dyslexic people with names after your houses, I've got a new goal in life.
Yeah, exactly. You need to get your name up there.
I can't believe it. I'm writing that down. That's going on my list.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay then. So if anyone wants to find you, what's the best way they can find you?
Yeah, go to the lovely website that we've talked about. I think on the website as well, we've tried to put loads of videos on there with the kids talking, because I think if you are a parent and you're thinking about schooling for your child, and looking at potential options, the best thing to do is to look at the website and to see what it's like from the child's perspective. Even when we have open days, normally not under COVID situation, the children do the tours with the parents, because I think that's really important, because they're the most honest advocates of the school. If they don't like something, they'll say that they don't like it. But to their credit, they're all super positive. And when I've got an open day, like the assemblies where I ask for volunteers, I normally have too many children volunteering that they want to tour around the parents. I think that's the best thing. Look at the website, listen to the videos of the kids, come and see the school, see if it's right for your child. We're looking at starting up sort of training events for parents as well, so that they can come here, listen to our teachers speak about different things, and then maybe go back to the child's current school and say, oh, Moon Hall's trying this, have you heard of this? Or what about introducing this into your lessons? Not in a sort of condescending way to the other schools, but we also try and share good practice from other schools as well. We have visitors come in that are constantly training our staff. So I would just say to parents to sort of look on the website, and also to look at if Moon Hall's not logistically possible for them. There are other schools around the country that specialise in dyslexia, and on the British Dyslexia Association's website, there's lots of information there about specialist schools. There's also lots of parents' information on the BDA website as well about sort of how to approach your school and ask for extra help, template letters and checklists and all these kind of things that are, so there is information out there for parents to help with the support of their child.
Amazing. Thank you very much for coming on.
That's all right. I liked it. It was very good. I feel like this is my specialist subject. If it was mastermind, then it would be okay.
What an episode full of nuggets of really valuable information. Before we get into that, famous dyslexics.
Well, the main one that everyone thinks of is Richard Branson. It's the first one that comes to everyone's mind.
As the production team behind a podcast about dyslexia, we've spent lots of time looking at who's dyslexic, who might be interesting to get on the show. So I guess I have a bit of a working knowledge of some famous dyslexics, but you're right to think of Richard Branson. He's the one that comes to mind. Theopithetus is another that's really well known, has a perceived huge success, but is dyslexic. There are all kinds of people. Really interesting to use these icons as a way of reassuring our kids that it's okay.
I mean, why wouldn't you do it? If you want to become a racing driver, you look at inspirational racing drivers, you know, or a footballer, you idolise your main footballers. But the thing is, because the world's framed it in a negative way, they're like, why would we tell people about something that's negative? And that's not what we need to do. There's so many positives out there. And these these celebrities, and you guys can't see me, but I'm using the bunny ears when I say celebrities, the people who are well known are never really out there. And the reason why I said Richard Branson is because he is a person that's really pushed it. And like I said, Theo Pathetis is another one. Entrepreneurs that really...
Some other dyslexics that aren't necessarily so realistic to get on the podcast, but I should mention are Albert Einstein. Was dyslexic.
Yeah.
Walt Disney.
Yeah.
Was dyslexic. And that's interesting because we had a comic on the show a couple of weeks ago. Leonardo da Vinci, another visual person, an artist similar to Willard, who was on the show a few weeks ago, the microscopic artist. He's not microscopic. The artist is not microscopic. Orlando Bloom.
Yeah.
Maggie Pocock, the astronomer.
Yeah.
Jim Carrey. The list goes on.
It does. And if there's one thing you notice about all them people is the creative side. And that's something that we all need in the world. Creativeness is so important. And then there's these people standing there at the forefront with this perceived disability leading the way.
We also tried to get a couple of other dyslexics on the show, but they aren't available. Winston Churchill and Napoleon, both dyslexic, both said they weren't up for it.
No, but they did say they'd come next month.
Thomas Edison, Robin Williams, so many famous dyslexic people. And it's what you say is right. The creative streak runs through all these people. Back to Michelle.
Yes.
She was a fantastic guest. Her passion for neurodiversity comes through so strongly. And the wonderful work that she does at Moon Hall School in Reigate is second to none.
Yeah, that school, again, is... I've told my mum since that recording that I wish I went. And Reigate's not that far away from me. I actually lived near Reigate. And I was like, I could have gone to that school. But sadly, this is why I love this podcast. It's because it's promoting something that's out there. Who knew? And I guarantee you, the people listening would not have heard of dyslexic schools unless you've taken, and I only heard about that the first time I heard about that. I know I've mentioned Chris a few times, but Chris Donnelly's again, his school was specialised in dyslexia, and it's not something you hear. So, you know, I think it's important to see what these great people are doing out there.
Anyone who wants to learn more about the school Michelle Catterson runs, check out moonhallschoolreigate.co.uk. I won't spell that one out because it's probably a little bit too much on the show, but we will link it in the show notes. Thank you, Michelle, so much for being a guest.
Yes, thank you, Michelle. And Michelle has also invited me to the school, which hopefully we'll be doing in some future episodes and meeting some of the kids.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. The Invisible Gift podcast has the social channels, which we would love for you to go check out at The Invisible Gift on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all the classic places. You're going to start a TikTok?
We are starting a TikTok. In fact, make sure you follow because we've got some great content coming up this season.
I actually think that could be really powerful for young people with dyslexia and TikTok.
Well, you've got to go where the podcast is directed at, and there's young people out there that there's a lot of stuff that this would be good for them, and TikTok is the place they are.
You can check out the previous episodes and what we're up to by visiting the website www.theinvisiblegift.com. And I guess apart from telling everyone what's going on next week, we've got anything else to share?
No, just make sure, guys, that if you haven't listened to season one, you go back there and listen. There's some great ones in there. And again, like I said last week, you can see me greatly improve between season one and two. And hopefully when season three comes, you're going to be like, whoa, he's great.
Really evolving.
Yeah.
So next week we have on the podcast the award-winning producer and BBC talent executive Carrie Britton.
I've got my nerves out already.
I'm a bit nervous about this one because, amongst other things, Carrie is the brains behind the TV show Who Do You Think You Are? And has been doing loads to promote cognitive diversity at the Beeb. But for me, it means that she knows how to tell a story. She's gonna, I imagine, critique our narrative arc as producers. And so, you know, we're gonna have to be on top form next week.
And for me, I get to find out if you're any good.
Well, exactly. So, all in all, Connor, what were you thinking when you put... No, I'm joking. It's gonna be an absolute delight to have Carrie on the show. You're speaking to her in the coming days. So next week, we'll find out all about it.
Yeah, I can't wait.
All right, I think that's probably about it for this week.
That's it. See you next week. Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. You've been listening to the Invisible Gift podcast, presented by me, Andrew Kitley, and produced by One Fine Play. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy, and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to the Invisible Gift podcast.